President Donald Trump says he sent a letter to Iran hoping to negotiate a deal to stop their nuclear ambitions.
But we have a situation with Iran that something's going to happen very soon. Very, very soon.
An emergency summit in Brussels about European security and Ukraine.
The ReArm Europe plan provides up to 800 billion euros for defense investment.
Join us now on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. I'm Scott Walterman in Washington.
Hopefully we can have a peace deal. You know, I'm not speaking out of strength or weakness. I'm just saying I'd rather see a peace deal than the other. But the other will solve the problem.
U.S. President Donald Trump says he sent a letter to Iran's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei offering to start negotiations on ending Iran's nuclear weapons program.
We're down to the final moments. We're at final moments. You can't let them have a nuclear weapon.
According to Iran's mission to the United Nations in New York, they have not yet received the letter, at least as of Friday afternoon. So let's talk more about this from a big picture perspective. Joining us now is Alex Vatanka, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. He specializes in Middle Eastern regional security affairs with a particular focus on Iran. So thank you very much for coming on and hopefully helping walk us through what's going on.
I'll do my best.
So let's go big picture. President Trump says he sent a letter to Ali Khamenei saying he wants to negotiate a deal after pulling out of the deal that we had in the first administration. Where are we relationship-wise with Iran?
Look, in terms of where we are, one way of looking at it is to say we're in the same place we've been literally for the last many years, certainly going back to 2018 when the first Trump administration imposed the maximum pressure campaign on Iran, because, you know, the U.S. is still out of the nuclear deal that was signed in 2015. On paper, the United States is still committed to the maximum pressure campaign. In fact, the president, in his few weeks in office, has reiterated that that's what he intends to do, to squeeze the Iranian economy. Other senior Trump officials are saying they will, you know, do what they can to destabilize Iran's economy. So that has not really changed, that the sort of stick part of the equation. In terms of the carrot, if I could call it a carrot, a couple of things stand out. Number one is Trump administration 2.0 is very different from the first Trump administration in the sense that, President Trump so far, if you listen to him, the one thing that he keeps going back to in terms of he must have it is that Iran does not weaponize its nuclear program. That's his red line. That's very different than the sort of demands we heard from Trump administration in the first term. You know, we all remember Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's 12-point demands, which wasn't just about Iran's nuclear program. It was about its missiles, its proxy network in the region, its human rights record, much more extensive, which essentially amounted to United States back then asking Iran to capitulate. That's not the case today. It's much more of a narrow focus. It's on the weaponization part of Iran's nuclear program. And if you look at it that way, on paper, there is a convergence here because the Iranians, certainly Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader who President Trump sent this letter to, has come out, repeatedly said weaponization of Iran's nuclear program is anti-Islamic. It's against the religion that he, you know, claims to represent. And therefore, you could see that, you know, today, early 2025, if they stick to that issue, weaponization or not, there is grounds for agreement. We just have to wait and see if that is genuinely what President Trump is interested in, or whether once the talks start going, he'll move the goalpost, if you will, and he'll add more demands. Because I think that's fundamentally the fear of Ali Khamenei. My bet is if Ali Khamenei knew for sure that President Trump really just has one thing on his mind, is that Iran doesn't weaponize, I think a serious conversation can be had, because Khamenei is willing to give that to President Trump. But Khamenei does not have the trust whether that will remain the case or whether the American president will just play games with him, change his mind, and add more to the list of demands from him, which from Khamenei's point of view, is the beginning of a slippery slope that will bring the Islamic Republic, his beloved system, the one that he has ruled over since 1989, to an end.
They've started making more almost weapons grade material. Is that a negotiating tactic? I mean, like they had my numbers might be a little off. I think it was like 400 pounds, and now they have 600 pounds. But there was a rapid increase in near weapons grade uranium since Trump won the election.
Right. No, I mean, Scott, the numbers are constantly changing. What is, in terms of the important thing to take away, is that the Iranians are enriching at a higher level. They're saying they will expand if they have to. And I think, to your point, it's about leverage. It's about leverage. In fact, I would go as far as saying everything U.S. and Iran do vis-a-vis each other at this point, it's about leverage. I don't think we're at a point where we can talk about, you know, Iran and U.S. going to war. I certainly don't think Washington or Tehran interested in that scenario. But when you're seeing Trump administration in its first few weeks in office reintroducing the idea of implementing maximum pressure campaign, which, by the way, never went away under the Biden administration, but President Trump has said he will forcefully implement it, or the sort of flying over Middle East with the B-52s, or the notion, as was reported by some in the media, that, you know, U.S. will maybe take Iranian oil tankers by force. All of these things are essentially aimed at one thing, to get the attention of the other side, in the hope that once they sit down at that table and negotiate, that they go in with the best, strongest hand that they have. It's true for both sides. So what U.S. does is aim to get Iran's attention, and all the talk on the Iranian side about we're going to enrich more and all the rest of it is designed to create leverage for themselves. End of the day, I think most analysts will tell you, if Iran really wanted to weaponize, they've had the technical capacity to do it for some time. They're not doing it because the cost-benefit analysis, from their perspective, still is one where Iran is better off being where it is right now, using the nuclear program as a leverage in terms of its future of relations with the United States and the rest of the world, as opposed to, you know, going all out and weaponizing, becoming a North Korea-style country, but then paying the consequences in the sense of isolating the place more so than it already is.
Well, and given what they've been through with Hamas and Hezbollah, this would really kind of be a good deal for them, right? They put this to bed, everything cools down on them for a while, and they can rebuild.
Look, if you were Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, or one of the senior generals in the Revolutionary Guards in Tehran that essentially are running Iran's regional agenda, you would say this would be a good deal, because this gives him a way out, gives Iran the option to actually look and turn to their own people, who are desperately, desperately asking for the Khamenei regime to focus on events in Iran, to look at getting the sanctions lifted, to improve living standards. I mean, as we're speaking here today, Scott, we're a few weeks away from the Persian New Year. And if you listen to what's happening in Iran, people are just desperate, because this is a time of the year you're supposed to go out there and, you know, buy gifts for your family members, fix up your house, go on holiday, do the good things people do in a festive season. And yet what we're hearing is that people are so broke, there is no money. And that has created a sort of an anger in society. And obviously that anger is immediately linked to the nature of the regime's foreign policy pursuits. The nuclear issue is one. What they're doing in the region is another. So if they did want to sort of take this deal, if there is a deal to be had, this offer of talking to President Trump, they're doing themselves a major favor. But I'm speaking as someone who's not looking at this ideologically. But if you're an Islamist ideologue in Tehran, if you believe that the economy is nothing compared to what the sort of sacred mission of fighting Israel or United States in the Middle East, then they're not going to necessarily take my advice or take a deal with the Trump administration, but look for ways to, you know, perhaps go back to Syria. I mean, again, we're talking at a day where there are new clashes in Syria, question marks if Iran is involved. If Iran is involved, wants to come back to Syria, you know, it tells us that they haven't really learned any new lessons from the fall of the Assad regime, that they're still pretty much determined to stay the course, axis of resistance, fight the Americans, fight Israel, and sacrifice Iran's economy in the process. But again, it's too early. I don't know where Iran is going, but to your point, where in terms of Iran's regional agenda, for sure, no doubt, they are shaken to the core because Assad wasn't supposed to fall the way he did. Hezbollah and Hamas were certainly not supposed to be decimated by Israel and the U.S. in the course of months last year the way they were. So, you know, this is a really interesting time, moment for the Iranian leaders to again, make a fundamental decision. What's in the best interest of the Iranian people, the national interest of Iran? And vast majority of Iranians, I have no doubt, will tell you it's a good time to make compromises across the board. But, you know, the leaders, obviously, Iran is not a democracy. Ayatollah Khamenei doesn't depend on anyone's votes to be a supreme leader. And we have to wait and see what he decides.
Hmm. Alex, fascinating, as always. We'll keep an eye on it, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Pleasure speaking to you, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Alex Fatenka, the senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. You're listening to Issues in the News on The Voice of America. I'm Scott Walterman.
We want a peace through strength. And this is the reason why I present today to the leaders the Rearm Europe plan.
European leaders on Thursday said they would stand by Ukraine and spend more on defense in a world upended by President Donald Trump's reversal of U.S. policies. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the summit in Brussels and described her vision of rearming Europe and supplying Ukraine with weapons.
It gives the member states possibility to invest in the Ukrainian defense industry or to procure military capabilities that go right away to Ukraine.
We made a strong signal to Ukrainian people, to Ukrainian warriors, to civilians, to all our families. And it's great that we are not alone. We feel it and we know it. Thank you so much for everything.
According to NATO, Washington provided more than 40% of military aid sent to Ukraine last year.
If you didn't have our military equipment, this war would have been over in 2 weeks.
In three days. I heard it from Putin. In 3 days.
But Trump abruptly ended that arms supply following an Oval Office shouting match with Zelensky last week that led to a reversal in American support and stunned American allies. In the days since, that shock has hardened into a new resolve, driven by fears that Russia, emboldened by its war in Ukraine, may attack an EU country next, and that Europe cannot rely on the U.S. to come to its aid. In a televised address on the eve of the summit, French President Emmanuel Macron said, "I want to believe that the United States will stand by us, but we have to be ready if that is not the case." And in a sign of the gravity of the moment, Macron said that France was open to discussing extending the protection offered by its nuclear arsenal to its European partners. Moscow said Macron's speech contained notes of what it called nuclear blackmail. the French proposal was met with mixed reaction from other nations.
I think it's a very interesting idea, and we see to this proposal with high expectations because, you know, nuclear umbrella would serve as really very serious deterrence towards Russia.
That was Lithuania's President Gitanas Nausėda. So let's pull out a bit and get an overview of the changing mood and landscape in Europe. Joining us now from Paris to help us understand all of this is Nicholas Tenzer, a non-resident senior fellow at the Democratic Resilience Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis. Thank you so much for being able to join us to talk about this.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, emergency summit in Brussels as the EU tries to navigate what seems to be a new world. The possibility that the United States might not be there for the first time since World War II. What do we know of what happened in Brussels?
Well, basically, I think there is at least a kind of awareness that basically we are at war with Russia. And I think it was really pointed out by President Macron last evening. And now I think this awareness is shared by most of the European leaders. And we have absolutely no time to lose. Not only in terms of basically stepping up, in terms of defense and probably to reach, 4% of the GDP devoted to defense for the countries who are not at that stage, but also to create an industrial base for European industry. And as you say, this time is really unprecedented because already there is a lot of alarm, including from myself, about the fact that the U.S. could basically not meet the security challenges that Europe is facing. It was really clear already in Georgia in 2008, and basically the U.S. did nothing. It was clear in Syria in 2013 when President Obama refused to enforce the red lines that he himself set. It was true also in 2014 when Ukraine already was attacked by Russia. And even since 2022, I think the U.S. Basically remained halfway, but so the Europeans. But now the challenge is completely different. It's not only the questions of abandonment by the U.S., but right now the U.S. is playing against us. The UN Security Council, when it comes to the P5 members, the permanent members of the UNSC, we were three against two, namely Russia and China. Now we are two against three, including the U.S. So basically, I think the future of Europe is at stake, and more immediately, the future of Ukraine. If we are not providing as swift as possible all the weapons Ukraine needs, not only to defend itself, but also to repel the Russian aggressor, then I think we perfectly know that we'll be the next on the list. And that's the kind of consciousness that the Europeans right now have.
I saw Starmer today in a boat factory in England, and he was saying exactly what you're saying. We need to start making vessels. We need to make other things. We need to use our own industries to pivot to producing the kinds of arms and material that we need not only to defend ourselves but to protect Ukraine.
Yes, exactly. And it's nice that you talk about the UK because I think when it comes to defense, basically it's not only the EU that is concerned. And in terms of military alliance, we certainly will have to create something. And hence, of course, the summit on Sunday, in London, we have to also ally with the UK, with Norway, with Canada, and maybe we will have, at the end of the day, to extend this alliance to countries such as Japan, South Korea, Australia. So, I mean, also the questions of the future of NATO is at stake as well. Because if we have not, the fact that the U.S. leaves NATO because I think that he won't. But if basically the effort made by the U.S. Within NATO, not only in terms of military spendings, but also in terms of technical capabilities, notably military intelligence. If this disappears, and I think it will, we will have certainly to replace NATO or to create a kind of new NATO.
I've heard that theory. It goes like this. If the U.S. view is now that there are only three powers, China, Russia, and the United States, that blocks like the EU need to expand to other areas and other partners to counterbalance or create in the aggregate that kind of global power?
Well, I think that's basically we will have to do that. We will have to aggregate, not saying that there will be a kind of unique government and unique foreign policy of all the EU member states plus UK and others. It means that certainly we will have to replace the US, and we will have also to confront not only Russia, but as you rightly said, also China in other parts of the world. Because certainly I think that if Russia wins in Ukraine and is able to dismantle the EU, certainly it will be a very good kind of godsend for China as well. And so it means that we will have certainly to face many enemies, you know, at the same time. But just look, that was recalled by Prime Minister Donald Tusk, you know, of Poland. Basically, Russia is 140 million people. The U.S. is 320, and Europe is 500 million. Yeah. So basically, we have the power. We have the power. And I think that at the end of the day, it will be very beneficial also for Europe. Just remember that what in the US the DARPA did in the early 60s, DARPA was very instrumental, not only for the military sector, but also for the civil sector. And so I think that there will be a kind of very good effects on the whole industry, but also on employment, growth, etc., for Europe, if we are turning our economies into war economies.
Is this the kind of moment? Europe, the EU has always been contentious because there are different interests. Does this one of those moments where the EU could actually come together really for the first time in a single purpose?
I think it's possible. And I think it's possible, but even likely. I think it's likely because we are really living in a kind of dramatic moment. And I know, I mean, you're perfectly right in pointing out all the divergences, divergent interests of the EU member states. But no, it's no time, I think, to be competitors. It's time to have some shared views. Otherwise, it will be completely suicidal. I am not saying that all the EU countries immediately we embrace, I mean, the same stance and the same resolve. But I think is that if we consider, for instance, what France can do, but also Germany with Merz, but also the UK, Poland, the Baltic states, Nordic states, but also Spain and Italy right now, I think there will be this common base to advance on common interest, whatever, I mean, the political contentious views on many other issues, such as social issues, migration issues, etc. And I think that basically this kind of, a new dimension for Europe. I remember was Ursula von der Leyen was firstly elected the chairwoman of the European Commission. She was talking about, you know, the geopolitical Europe, but in fact it was void or it was meaningless at that time. No, it becomes a kind of new reality.
Thank you so much for the insight. Really interesting.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure, really.
Nicholas Tenzer, a non-resident senior fellow with the Democratic Resilience Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis, joining us from Paris. This has been VOA's Issues in the News. For more information throughout the week, listen to our daily podcast, The Issue, available on voanews.com or wherever you get your podcasts from. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Scott Walterman in Washington.